Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, October 2nd, and I'm Nat Cardos, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Eureka traffic stop leads to arrest and seizure of ammunition, firearm, and suspected controlled substances. Access Humboldt pivots to survive radical shift in funding. Governor Newsom passes Bill AB 263, protecting water flows for salmon strongholds. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Yesterday, October 1st, at approximately 9:23 a.m., a Eureka Police Department patrol officer conducted a traffic stop and found driver identified as 19-year-old Blake Richardson in possession of ammunition in the front area of his vehicle, despite being legally prohibited from possessing firearms or ammunition. KMUD News spoke with Laura Montagna, Eureka Police Department's public information officer, for more information on the ensuing arrest.
On October 1st, 2025, at approximately 9:23 a.m., a Eureka Police Department patrol officer conducted a traffic enforcement stop near 1st and F Street. During the stop, the driver, identified as 19-year-old Blake Richardson, was found to be legally prohibited from possessing firearms or ammunition. Ammunition was located in the front area of the vehicle, and Richardson was taken into custody. With assistance from a Humboldt County Sheriff's Office K-9 team, a subsequent search of the vehicle uncovered additional ammunition in the trunk, along with several small bags containing a suspected controlled substance. A deputy from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit was also dispatched to safely handle a modified illegal firework found inside the vehicle. A follow-up search of Richardson's residence was conducted, resulting in the discovery of a handgun equipped with an illegal magazine and additional suspected controlled substances. Richardson was transported and booked into the Humboldt County Correctional Facility for violation of a court order, possession of a controlled substance, possession of ammunition by a prohibited person, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. This remains an active investigation. In order to preserve its integrity, additional details are not being released at this time.
Anyone with information related to this incident is encouraged to contact Eureka Police Department's Criminal Investigations Unit at 707-441-4300. An online presentation from the Executive Director of Access Humboldt highlighted new challenges to public media funding. Daniel Mintz reports.
The Access Humboldt Public Media Center is transforming to survive a funding crisis driven by the decline of cable TV and cuts to federal grants. Christina Marie Jeffers, Access Humboldt's recently hired executive director, told attendees of an October 1st Community Economic Resilience Consortium meeting that the center is facing a, quote, radical shift that emerged this year. The center's traditional funding source, a small fee on cable bills, is rapidly dwindling as more residents cut the cord and switch to broadband internet services. The broadband companies are not obligated to fund public access, education, and government channels, even though they use public rights of ways for their infrastructure. With local public access TV funding diminishing, Jeffers was hired as executive director largely due to her fundraising experience, she said. But it's not an opportune time for fundraising.
Because of the national dialogue and the federal cuts in funding, some would argue that we weren't affected by that, but that's just simply not true. Even though we rely on the franchise fees from cable, we do have co-granting with like KMUD and other stations that are like KEET. We've done collaborations before, and those collaboration opportunities are now gone from CBP funding being cut. Also, with the other federal cuts to like the parks, the windmills, pretty much any federal funding that Eureka and Humboldt County gets has caused layoffs and unemployment. So what do people do first when they're unemployed? They mind their bills and cut things like cable. So we have actually had a drastic fall off in our funding as well this year.
To counter shrinking revenue, Access Humboldt is implementing an aggressive fundraising and program development strategy. The momentum began with the Bold Day of TV event, which produced over 200 minutes of interviews on the goals and needs of 20 local organizations. In response to federal cuts and in collaboration with local nonprofits, Access Humboldt then raised over $13,000 regionally, with $6,000 in matched funds, in a follow-up fundraising event dubbed the Bold Day of Giving. Access Humboldt expects to raise $50,000 by the end of the year and has already raised about $38,000. Jeffers also highlighted recent program development, which includes support for free speech through community access to Access Humboldt's public TV facilities.
I cannot tell you how important public access is and our governmental programs, how keeping government open at the local level, it is paramount right now to keeping our democracy. So if you have a story to tell, if you want to be on cable TV and streaming and web, please come by the station. Please become a member. It's only $50 a year, and you get all of the benefits, including our studio, our equipment, one-on-one training, our computer lab, field gear. If you have something that you want to say, if you just want to exercise your voice because it feels good, if you're feeling frustrated or that there's like no hope right now, come say it out loud, put it on TV, exercise your free speech. It'll actually make you feel a lot better.
But this is going on as funding gaps widen. Jeffers said recent fundraising, quote, will fill most of the gap that we projected, but, quote, I won't know how big that hole is because every quarter it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Greg Foster, the meeting's host and executive director of the Redwood Region Economic Development Commission, is also Access Humboldt's treasurer. He detailed the funding struggle's dollar amounts and a shift away from fee-based revenue.
I started on the board and became treasurer, 8 years ago, 6 years ago? I don't know. I just finished the second term. We were getting upwards of $76,000, $77,000 a quarter to support all of our services. And now we're down to about $62,000, $63,000. So that's been a pretty big drop over a period of time. And, you know, all do most of the streaming of government meetings and some of the other stuff on the government channel that's really important, and plus the archives. So we are really having to transition to a more community, rather than a fee-based model of operating based on a negotiated contract with, a previously negotiated contract with Cox Cable. We're now really having to look at more community support for ourselves. And that's, as Christina mentioned, doubly true for KMUD and Keat and some of the others that got Corporation for Public Broadcasting money and it's dried up.
To survive in the new funding scenario, Access Humboldt and other nonprofit public media outlets are, quote, really going to become even more community focused as we go forward, Foster said. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On September 26, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed Bill AB 263 into law. This bill ensures that there are minimum flow regulations in place for the Shasta and Scott Rivers so that salmon populations are able to go upstream. This is supposed to help in the regrowth of salmon populations in the Klamath Water Basin and eventually restore species that have been dying off. KMUD News spoke with Amber Jameson, Water Advocacy Director at the Environmental Protection Information Center, EPIC, for more information on what this bill does.
So AB 263 provides a safety net to ensure that minimum in-stream flows are kept in place until permanent regulations are set. A couple of years ago, a drought declaration had been made by the governor, and so based on that, emergency regulations were put into place to keep a minimum in-stream flow. And so now we're working on permanent regulations, but every year these temporary emergency regulations expire. And so this will keep the emergency regulations in place until the final regulations are put into place, the permanent ones.
Essentially, AB 263 ensures that there are emergency in-stream flow requirements that will keep enough water in the rivers to keep temperatures cool enough for salmon to thrive. Prior to this bill, the first emergency in-stream flow requirements were set only in 2021, but they were temporary and required the Water Board to adopt them every year. KMA News spoke with Angeline Cook, a restoration associate with the California Sport Fishing Protection Alliance, for more information on how low in-stream flows affect salmon populations in the rivers.
When rivers have a minimum amount of flow, they are much less likely to heat up to the point where it's inhospitable for salmon. And because the Shasta and Scott are two of the most productive tributaries in the Klamath River system, a significant percentage of salmon return to the Scott and Shasta every summer to spawn and rear. And so when river or when creeks and tributaries don't have sufficient amount of water in them, they just get overheated. A lot of our higher elevation tributaries like the Shasta and Scott, they've been denuded of trees along the riparian zone, like that generally typically line the creek beds, but because the land and the watershed has been utilized for cattle grazing and crop cultivation, the natural river system has changed. And so low flows in the creek are more vulnerable to overheating.
The move also ensures that hatchery salmon are able to interact and breed with wild salmon in the rivers, which would increase biodiversity and help establish larger salmon populations. It complements the recent Klamath Dam removals, allowing salmon that were raised in hatcheries along the rivers to return to where they used to be and spawn. KMA News spoke with Nick Jocelyn, advocacy director at the Mount Shasta Bioregional Ecology Center and the president of Friends of the Shasta River, for more on how this bill's passage coincides with the dam removals.
Basically, what this is going to do is keep salmon from going extinct. And after the Klamath dams were removed, fish that had swum past the Scott and Shasta were met with the first dam of the four that were removed. And at that point, they were essentially scooped up by a fish hatchery, and that was that for them. There was no spawning above those dams for fish. And so now with those dams gone, what you will have are hatchery genetic fish swimming back because they're now imprinted on that hatchery flow. That hatchery is no longer there, but you also have the healthy or surviving stocks of the Scott and Shasta who will potentially stray. And so that wild genetic that's left in Scott and Shasta salmon will be able to help populate the mid-Klamath in the reaches that were formerly reservoirs. And that's sort of a crucial point because they are supporting Klamath River fish with a new hatchery, but it's only supposed to run for a handful of years. And so the hope is that we will get enough wild stock joining that hatchery stock and producing fish that swim far above where the dams were. And we've seen some indication that that is already starting to happen.
This bill is part of Governor Newsom's Salmon Strategy, which is a document that was adopted for the state of California to make more efforts to help restore California's salmon populations in the face of increasing drought. Cook elaborates a bit on what the Salmon Strategy entails.
It's a document that Governor Newsom adopted a couple of years ago, and it lines out the administration's acknowledgement that salmon populations are in steep decline in California, and we have to do something about the habitat to make sure that we don't extinguish salmon, which is one of the state's most fundamental keystone species. But populations have been so bad over the past couple of decades. In the last 3 years, the state has had to close the entire commercial salmon fishery. So yeah, it was a strategy that the governor drafted to define opportunities for salmon recovery and deploy those strategies.
Prior to the bill being passed, the river was being overdrawn due to too many people having rights to water and not enough water to go around. This over-allocation of water combined with the drought makes the water too warm for salmon. Jocelyn elaborates more on the issue.
Well, most rivers in California would be considered over-allocated in that on paper, there are more water rights holders with guaranteed water rights than there is water in the river. And it's not only a condition that's been hastened by recent climate change, but it's also sort of just a historic strangeness to our water rights system where people could basically apply for water rights in the mid-1800s, early 1900s, and there was really no reason for any agency to say no at the time. They weren't really taking into account beneficial uses such as fish or cold water or tribal rights, tribal subsistence fishing. It was more a matter of the beneficial use being considered agriculture, and so there's sort of a priority put on that beneficial use above all other uses. And so the rights to nature to have water and rights to the river to be wet were not really considered at the time. And so we just ended up with a giant stack of paper water rights and not enough wet water to satisfy those rights. And that's typically what you'd consider over-allocated. In California, people estimate it's anywhere from 3 to 7 times over-allocated, basically, in most streams. So commonly more water demanded than there is water supplied.
This is a win for the rivers and a step towards restoring salmon populations in California. Salmon species like Chinook and Coho salmon rely on being able to travel to their spawning grounds to continue in the face of declining populations.
Well, it's kind of a complicated issue. And we're not asking, like some people falsely pit farms against fish, and that's not it at all. We want to avoid and rewrite that narrative. We think farms and fish can flourish as neighbors hand in hand, but the irrigators need to get a lot more conservative and more careful about the crops they choose to cultivate in areas that also happen to serve as salmon stronghold tributaries. So it's fascinating and complex issue, and I invite anybody who's interested in learning more to get more informed and keep track of what the state is doing. I think the irrigators have been very successful in vocalizing their opinions and directing policy in this state, and the tribes and fishing communities and environmentalists. We have recently made the incredible victory of Klamath Dam removal. And so in order for this state to follow through on its investments in Klamath River restoration, we have got to implement recovery flows in our tributaries. So I encourage everyone to keep track of the story and voice your support for salmon. It's kind of was once upon a time the backbone of our economy, and it could be an integral part of our thriving state once again if we rearrange priorities.
For more information on the bill, you can look it up on calmatters.digitaldemocracy.org. In state news, California's 40th lawsuit against Trump administration gets court order protecting FEMA preparedness grants, KPFA's Kennedy Coelho reports.
State Attorney General Rob Bonta sued the Trump administration and, for now at least, he won. AG Bonta announced the lawsuit Tuesday after the administration placed what he called unlawful conditions on grants from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and Department of Homeland Security, or DHS. The Homeland Security Grant Program, which totals approximately $1 billion in funds annually, funds emergency preparedness not just for natural disasters, but counterterrorism as well. Bonta says it's political persecution and illegal.
The defining factor appears to be political. And while we're still gathering information, it appears that whether a state is a so-called sanctuary jurisdiction may be behind these cuts. These cuts are simply unfair. They're made without good reason, and they go beyond the powers FEMA is legally allowed to use.
David Chu, the city attorney for San Francisco, agreed with the sentiment. Chu announced Wednesday that the city and county would be a part of a lawsuit with over 20 other local governments against the Trump administration over this FEMA grant. He focuses on how this will impact the safety of Californians as major events come to the state in the coming years, including the NFL's big game and multiple World Cup matches taking place in Santa Clara next year. Chu says securing these events will cost into the millions as preparations have already begun.
Our cities and counties, we are already planning what we need to ensure that everyone can attend those events and feel safe, and that our visitors from around the world can come and be safe. But without millions of dollars to do that preparation, it forces us to pull dollars from other places within our communities. Most cities and counties in recent years have been dealing with very significant budget challenges. It puts us in an impossible situation from a budget standpoint.
The suits by A.G. Bonta and Chu seek to block the administration from withholding funds, which they say will help respond to weather and security needs. Bonta emphasizes that what the administration is doing is illegal, that sanctuary policies have been upheld in the courts, and keeping money from jurisdictions because of those policies is unconstitutional. In filing this 40th lawsuit, Bonta makes clear that he will continue to take on the administration.
Our action today ensures that California can continue to prevent and respond to acts of terrorism, protect residents from natural disasters like wildfires and like floods, support local emergency management and law enforcement, and maintain strong, resilient communities. We're committed to holding the federal government accountable, including challenging unlawful attempts to politicize critical public safety resources. If a law is being violated, I'm going to step in.
A judge granted a temporary restraining order blocking FEMA from reallocating California's grant money Tuesday. Bonta and Chu hope to permanently block the administration's efforts. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
In national news, Trump administration reviewing abortion pill access based on dodgy study, KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the safety of the abortion pill, mifepristone. That's according to Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who shared the memo this week in a letter to Republican attorneys general. On Monday, California Attorney General Rob Bonta pushed back. He issued a joint statement defending the drug safety and warning against political interference in FDA decisions. The review follows pressure from Republicans who called on the agency to restrict or even pull mifepristone from the market. Kennedy, in June, asked FDA Commissioner Martin McCary to examine what he called the, quote, latest data on the drug. But much of that data comes from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a conservative Christian think tank. Their report claims that nearly 11% of patients suffer serious complications within 45 days of taking mifepristone. But medical experts have challenged those findings. Speaking to CBS News, Dr. Celine Gounder, an American physician and medical journalist, points out that other research shows the risk is far lower.
The authors are not medical professionals. The study was not reviewed by experts in the field. This was not published in a scientific publication. And I think also importantly, they did not reveal the sources of their data or their methodology.
Mifepristone has been used for more than 25 years and is currently the most common method for early-term abortion care in the United States. Attorney General Rob Bonta said the decision to re-examine access to this medication was made in response to a, quote, scientifically baseless letter and ignores decades of research that proves mifepristone is safe and effective, close quote. Bonta continued by stating if access to mifepristone is challenged, that California would take action to protect it. But experts warn it could have sweeping impacts, even in the Golden State.
This Health and Human Services Department is dangerous.
That was Planned Parenthood of Northern California spokesperson Christian Garcia.
The moment the federal government makes any kind of decision that says that, you know, MIFI is no longer accessible, that's going to, you know, put a pause here in California as well, because we wouldn't have access to that medication.
And while Attorney General Bonta says he's committed to defending and preserving California's access to reproductive health care, Planned Parenthood says they also have a plan B.
Misoprostol regimen is the other medication that's used along MIFI. It is what the world uses everywhere else. And so it's safe to use, and we'll, you know, pivot to that if we need to. But our hope is that, as we've seen before, there's no legal standing for MIFI to be overturned. I think these are just efforts to try to create chaos and distract, but we're going to do everything we can to fight if we need to.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy and the FDA Commissioner Martin McCary say the review is underway, but did not disclose when it would be complete. Depending on the outcome, access could be limited, making the drug harder to obtain through telehealth or mail, or restricting prescriptions to doctors only, rather than nurse practitioners or physician assistants who are currently authorized to prescribe it. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe has denounced the decision by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth not to revoke medals awarded for one of history's most infamous massacres. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has more.
In late December 1890, members of the 7th Cavalry attempted to disarm a large group of Chief Spotted Elk's followers they had encircled at Wounded Knee Creek, South Dakota. A shot went off, and the soldiers mowed down the group of largely Native women, children, and elders with rifles and powerful Hotchkiss guns. 25 soldiers were killed by friendly fire as well. Later investigations showed fleeing survivors were chased down and killed where they stood. The following year, 20 U.S. soldiers received the Medal of Honor for gallantry at Wounded Knee, but top brass, including Major General Nelson A. Miles, condemned the incident as, quote, the most abominable military blunder and a horrible massacre of women and children. Efforts to revoke the medals gained momentum starting in 1990, the centennial of the incident. But in a video posted to his X account last week, Secretary Hegseth said the 20 soldiers who fired upon the Lakota natives will not have their medals revoked.
We're making it clear that they deserve those medals. This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate.
We'll continue to fight to get these medals rescinded.
Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out as a descendant of Spotted Elk and a Marine veteran of the Gulf War and Mogadishu. He says he's not surprised by Hegseth's decision, but it still speaks to the indifference of those who don't know their history.
It's despicable, it's untruthful, and insulting to our people.
In a press release, the Oglala Sioux Tribe says descendants of those scarred by Wounded Knee have served honorably in every U.S. conflict from World War I to Afghanistan. And every year, an annual memorial ride is held to honor those killed at Wounded Knee. Again, Frank Starr comes out.
This is history. This is something that our people are traumatized with, and we have to live with that. And I keep saying this every time I go to Washington to advocate, not only for the Oglala Sioux Tribe and tribes nationwide. You know, we were never dealt a fair hand.
Meanwhile, the National Congress of American Indians has also denounced Hegseth's decision and are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass what's called the Remove the Stain Act, so that, quote, the nation's highest honor fulfills its namesake by reflecting courage, not cowardice and cruelty. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Belfast City Council in Ireland approved a historic policy for the island's indigenous language, as Sean McPullen reports.
Belfast City Councillors approved the new Irish language policy this week. It comes after years of advocacy and consultations with the indigenous language community. The city plans to redesign its logo to now include the original Irish spelling of Bailfirstia, which means mouth of the Sandbank Ford. The policy also pledges to ensure all city signs contain both languages. Far-right councillors tried to block the new policy, but were unsuccessful. The council previously earmarked the equivalent of $2.5 million to fund the changes, as well as new initiatives that remove barriers for the use of Irish in public life. The Irish language has been experiencing a renaissance of late, particularly among young speakers, in part thanks to the worldwide success of the Belfast band Kneecap. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
The Cherokee Nation partnered with DreamWorks Animation and NBC Universal to dub the animated film How to Train Your Dragon in the Cherokee language. The Oklahoma Tribe held a private screening of the film this week, which is streaming on Peacock. It's part of the tribe's Cherokee language preservation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kennedy Coelho, Lauren Schmidt, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMA News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.